School of Thought, 101 Great Liberal Thinkers, profiles the lives and ideas of some of the leading thinkers on individual liberty, from ancient times to the present day. Award-winning author Dr. Eamon Butler outlines key elements of liberal thought and takes a chronological look at those who shaped it across the centuries. Eamon is director of the Adam Smith Institute, one of the world's leading policy think tanks. He holds degrees in economics and psychology, a PhD in philosophy, and an honorary D.Litt. So he's a very clever bloke, in other words. In the 1970s, he worked in Washington for the US House of Representatives and taught philosophy at Hillsdale College, Michigan, before returning to the UK to help found the Adam Smith Institute, a former winner of the Freedom Medal Award, awarded by Freedom's Foundation of Valley Forge, and the UK National Free Enterprise Award. Eamon is currently Secretary of the Mont Pelerin Society. In the book, Eamon identifies the common goals of these 101 great liberal thinkers, but also highlights their differing views on issues like the extent of government involvement in our daily lives. So for anyone interested in politics, government, social institutions, capitalism, rights, liberty and morality, School of Thought, 101 Great Liberal Thinkers provides a clear and concise introduction to a set of radical ideas and the thinkers behind them. I'm Darren Grimes, Digital Manager at the IEA, and I'm absolutely delighted to say that Eamon joins me now to discuss his latest book. Hi, Eamon.
Yes, hello, Adam.
Now, Eamon, I want to start by asking why you've decided to write this book now.
Well, like all of my books, which are little primers, really introducing subjects, free market, liberal subjects to people, really I wrote it for self-education so that I would actually have to learn about all these 101 scholars, thinkers, activists and the rest, and actually sharpen my own ideas by understanding where they were coming from and looking at the history of the development of liberal ideas over history, which is very interesting.
So there's no wider concern for you then on, are you trying to push liberal ideas because you agree perhaps with President Putin that liberalism is dead?
I think that liberalism always has to be rekindled in every generation. People forget things, and people are born all the time who never learn things because it sometimes doesn't feature in a country's news media, or even their culture. And therefore, you have to make ideas accessible so that people around the world can learn about these things, and perhaps they can take some of the positive lessons for their own countries or their own circumstances.
So going back then, thinking about the fact that my generation has completely forgotten about the winter of discontent and things like that.
Well, yes, and nobody under the age of about 45 can remember the Berlin Wall, which was absolutely obscene. It was the most awful scar on the planet. And I remember going through it at Checkpoint Charlie, and I remember going up the river in the middle of Berlin, and there were little white marker boys in the middle of the river saying Sektorgrenze, sector boundary. And on the other side were machine gun posts, and if you strayed across, you would be shot. Now, that's an obscenity, but people don't realise that these days, and young people in particular, I think, you know, they don't remember the horrors of communism and the hundreds of millions of people who were slaughtered either by neglect or, in many cases, deliberately by that system. So one has to keep saying these things.
And did you, when the wall fell, two questions, did you expect the wall to fall? And two, did you ever think that socialism and, to some extent, communism as well would be back in vogue in this country?
Well, we certainly never thought that the wall would fall. We thought it was going to be there forever, and it was only by a sort of accident that it did fall. And there was great euphoria, and we really thought, yes, liberal ideas have won, and Fukuyama wrote about the end of history and things like that. We were all liberals now. But then, of course, people regroup. And so these ideas have regrouped, And again, people who don't actually remember the reality are very attracted by these ideas because they are attractive ideas on the surface. You have to think about them more closely and deeply in order to realize they're false.
And with these ideas being popular ideas, does that mean then that you don't think that this is a liberal world?
It's an increasingly liberal world because people enjoy the practical benefits of liberalism. Mm. And that's really happened since about 1990, 1991. Since then, we've had the spread of globalization. We've had deregulation in a number of countries, particularly large ones like India. People can at last take some measure of control over their own lives in many places where that was impossible just 40 years ago, 30 years ago. So to that extent, it is increasingly liberal, and we have a much more liberal trade system, for example, and people can buy and sell their goods across the planet, and that has enriched particularly the poorest billions on the planet. And we are in the process of wiping out dollar a day and now $2 a day poverty. Mm-hmm. It's been in the most amazing transformation in my lifetime.
So what, going back a step then at a more reductive level, what is a liberal? What is your definition of someone who identifies as a liberal?
Well, you have to read my other book on classical liberalism.
I would endorse it. I would advocate everyone getting on and doing just that. But go on then, what would...
Well, liberals, first of all, put the individual above the collective. The most important thing is individuals. It's not a group. Groups don't think and they don't act. It's individuals act and think. Individuals have values. Groups don't have values. Groups are just collections of individuals. So putting the individual first, I think. Realizing that society can manage itself perfectly well without somebody in authority giving orders, what Hayek calls the spontaneous order. Animal societies flourish without there being a king or a prime minister or an army. They just respond to circumstances and form an order that evolves and which actually functions. And human society is a bit like that, and it's an aberration really that we have so many systems throughout the world where you have powerful people who are calling the shots. You know, it's been dictators and kings for centuries, and now it's really statist politicians. So that's another thing. And I think the important thing I would say is that liberals are tolerant. They don't have, if you like, a blueprint of society that everybody has to conform to. Their society is their heaven is many heavens. That you choose your own heaven. You choose what you want to do, and you allow people to have their own ambitions rather than trying to force them into your blueprint for society. So I think tolerance is hugely important.
The book goes through in chronological order, and it also explains the early origins of liberalism. I mean, what can you tell us where, I mean, has liberalism basically always been around? Have people always wanted freedom and liberty and to prioritize their own individual desires, etc., etc.?
I don't think it's ever really been the natural condition, because those with wealth and might, or those who've acquired wealth and might by taking wealth from other people, get themselves into positions of power. And that's, you know, so common everywhere in the world. And there aren't, you know, too many countries that you would really say this is a liberal country, even the so-called liberal democracies. Again, I've done another book for the IEA, which will be published soon on democracy. And when you look around the world, we talk about the liberal democracies in Europe. Are they really liberal democracies? I'm not so sure. They're run by power cliques and so on. So I don't think it's the natural condition, but it does spring up from time to time, and it certainly sprung up in Anglo-Saxon England, for example, where you had the most amazing system where it was a group of admittedly wise men, but it was a group of citizens who actually chose the monarch, and the monarch was limited in terms of their power. So that was remarkable. That, of course, came to an end in England with the invasion of the French in 1066, who imposed a much more top-down system. And it sort of came back again with Magna Carta in 1215, where the old Anglo-Saxon idea of individual freedom and you make your own way and you have your own property and people can't invade that property and they can't abuse that property and can't abuse you, started to come back with Magna Carta, and it carried on for many hundreds of years. It started to grow, and until, of course, then you had Charles I and the Glorious Revolution, which sort of encapsulated constitutionally the role of the monarch as being subservient to Parliament. Mm-hmm. What we've got now, unfortunately, is our democracy has turned into a kind of populism, and it's vote for me and I'll give you more and more favours at somebody else's expense. And of course, it's a very attractive election slogan, but it doesn't get you anywhere, I'm afraid. It imprisons you in the long term.
So then you write that this book gives school and university students of economics, politics, ethics and philosophy an introduction into a set of radical ideas and the thinkers responsible for them. Are you concerned that students just aren't being exposed to these sorts of ideas? And there's a lot of who argue that there's a left-leaning groupthink, which is more at ease with a dirigiste economy, command from the centre, and, well, I guess a one set of ideas, one set of ideology being exposed to at universities.
Well, it's a well-known fact that teachers in universities are more left-wing than the general population. And you can't say, oh, well, that's because they're very brainy and brainy people are left-wing. Actually, if you look at, again, the population of brainy people in the country, they split left and right pretty evenly. But academics split much more strongly in favour of the left. So students are getting this. And even if you're a good teacher, you're on the left, but you're a good teacher and you try to expose your students to non-left-wing ideas, nevertheless, there's a certain bias is bound to come out. So what I find is that students are desperate to find out these ideas. They don't really understand them. They don't know where they come from. They don't know what they mean, what their implications are, how to apply them in society. And they're absolutely agog to hear some of these things. And of course, what I hope is that in giving them access to these ideas, they can make life really difficult for their teachers.
Absolutely. Now, 101 thinkers, the 101 thinkers contained in the book, aren't exactly a nest of singing birds, which one might assume. There is a lot of disagreement within the classical liberal sphere and debates around many issues. Can you tell us about some of them?
Well, yes. I mean, liberalism itself is a debate. And the key element with the debate, of course, is how far should the state get involved in our lives? Are there things which are so important and which have such an important social effect or dimension that they've got to be organised collectively? And how much of our lives can we organise individually without there being sort of, if you like, spillover effects on other people? That's the fundamental debate. And that debate comes and goes over the centuries as new ideas come forward and affect it. And things like Hayek's idea of society is a spontaneous order. You don't really need to do much to sustain it. You just have to have a certain number of rules about how people should behave to each other, and then you get a very exciting society that makes its own way and grows and develops in ways that you can't possibly foresee. So that's sort of spontaneous order, and how far is it really a spontaneous order, and how far does it have to be planned, and how far do you need to set the rules, and what should the rules be? That's the sort of debate which has actually been in debate since ancient China. And it comes and goes as people forget it, and then they move on to something else, and then there's another thing, and things like rights. You know, the Americans, John Locke influenced the American revolutionaries, and with his theory of rights and so on, and there were natural rights, and other people like John Stuart Mill, and in particular, of course, Jeremy Bentham said that rights are nonsense on stilts, and it's natural rights nonsense on stilts. So where do rights come from? You know, we're all sort of agreed as liberals that, yes, there are certain things you can't do to people. You can't kill them. You can't injure them. You can't steal their property. But are there limits to that? You know, what exactly is my property? Can I stop somebody flying an aircraft over my garden? So these sorts of debates come and go. And of course, you get other debates coming, like the debate on slavery, emancipation, on female rights, which, again, were not recognized for many, many centuries. And even today, we have discussions as to what those rights should be and what the effects of those rights might be.
Mm-hmm. And now I asked you, because I was curious, and two, for this podcast, for your five favourites from the book. And I had anticipated that you'd go for stereotypical liberal thinkers, like Locke, Smith, Jefferson, Mill, Hayek. But you actually selected, and now pronunciation's Ibn Khaldun, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. Sir Edward Coke, John Lilburn and Richard Overton, Joseph Priestley and Josephine Butler. Now, I'm curious why you've selected them, and I wonder if you can tell us a bit about each of them. Is this you just being a contrarian, Eamon, and not wanting to go for the stereotypes?
Well, no. I mean, the people that you cite were all very great people. But I think people know a fair amount about Locke or Adam Smith or Hayek. These people,
not enough.
Not enough, perhaps. But, these people are all well known. But there's so many other people. I mean, I was slightly surprised I could get to a list of 101 without even, you know, doing very much effort. And I'm sure I could produce 201 without very much effort. There's a lot of liberal thinkers around who've made different contributions. Some of them aren't necessarily, actually, you wouldn't necessarily say they're liberals, but they've contributed something to the liberal debate. So there are some people who, you know, would not be liberal on many, many issues, but on one particular issue, they've been instrumental. I mean, Thomas Hobbes, for example, might be one of those. So I thought I would choose a list of those that people might not know, but who in their way were all very great people and who changed society because they had these liberal ideas.
And Khaldun, of course, Laffer-Curve, right?
Well, he was no nit. His name was actually Abd al-Rahman Ibn Muhammad Ibn Khaldun al-Hadrami of Tunis.
Wow.
Yeah, right. So he's a 14th century Islamic scholar and jurist. But he was also a bit of an economist as well, talked about property rights and incentives, and how when you attack property and you don't give people proper rights, then they sort of give up and say, well, what's the point of acquiring property? What's the point of planting seed if my crops are going to be taken from me by the government or indeed by anybody else? And also the right to a free commerce, he commented on, and he said that most people have only their labor, they don't have capital, and so if you force them to do something other than what they're good at, you will lose value and they will lose value. So if you want to maximize the value that human beings create and that they enjoy for themselves, let them do what they want, let them do what they're good at. The other great thing he said was that government is an institution which prevents injustice, he said, other than the injustice that it commits itself. That's a very important proviso.
I mean, we didn't learn much from him, did we? We didn't take that away. So next, Sir Edward Coke.
Well, it's actually pronounced Cook. That's the one you did mispronounce. He was another great man. It's to him that we get the expression, an Englishman's home is his castle. He didn't actually say that, but he said something very similar. And he rose up and became Attorney General to Elizabeth I. But he fell out with her because the Crown then was able to grant what was called patents or monopolies, basically, to chums. Started off as a way of protecting English industries, that you would grant them a monopoly, but then it became a way of rewarding your friends, and indeed you could sell these things to your friends and raise a bit of revenue. So he was very much against that, and he brought, as Attorney General, he brought the monarchic monopoly system under the courts. And then he became Chief Justice to James I, the Scottish king who became James I. But James revived the monopoly system, and so Cook actually wrote Parliament's response, asserting the rights of Parliament to control these things and lots of other things over the power of the monarch. So that was a pretty brave thing to do in the 1600s. And he also had a run-in with Charles I, who, of course, Charles jailed property owners who wouldn't pay taxes. Forced loans, basically, they were. He said, you had to pay this, and if you're not, then I'll take your property away. And that's where Cook said, no, the house of everyone is to him as his castle and fortress, as well as his defence against injury and violence. And that's the Englishman's home is his castle concept, which is very important. And he asserted the power of Magna Carta and drafted a petition of right and did all sorts of exciting things. So promoted the right to silence, independent judiciary. It's to him really that we owe habeas corpus. Yeah, great man.
And then Lilburn, I think, is your very favourite. Why is that?
Freeborn John, he was known as, because he's
born in the northeast, by the way.
Yeah,
so must
there
be sound.
There you go. he was a great guy. What a cool cat that guy was. He believed that people were born with certain natural rights, he spent years and years on and off in jail. He became really the head of a movement called the Levellers, and they weren't levellers because they believed in economic equality, but they believed in political and legal equality, and that was became an important reform movement. But he flouted the public's censorship of the time. We're talking the mid 1600s here, where any publication had to be basically approved and printed by the Company of Stationers, which was a quango effectively. And he produced his own, so he was brought to the Star Chamber, which is this sort of secret court that was used to stifle dissent. And shockingly, he refused to bow before the judges, and saying that they were just people on the same level as he was. They were just doing their job, he was doing his, and why should he bow to them? And for that, he got thrown in jail. And he did other things like other shocking things, like he demanded to know what the charges were that he was being arraigned on. He wouldn't sign a document that would make him incriminate himself. And so for all of those, this was a contempt of court. Mm-hmm. And for all of those things, he was whipped and pilloried. But even in the pillory, he handed out pamphlets to the passing public. Wow. And for that, he got another 3 years in jail. So he came and went. And during the English Civil War, he joined the parliamentarians, but was very soon criticizing Cromwell and the other parliamentarians for their religious intolerance and then for their lavish expenses and all the rest of it. He was banished for calling a parliamentary committee unjust and unworthy men who ought to be hanged, And then when he returned to England without authorization, he was jailed again, and so on and so on. So he spent his life in and out of jail, but he really did start a movement which questioned the authority of the time, and it was a very unjust authority of the time. So he was a really great man.
We've got a lot to be thankful for then in the case of John Lyle. And I think he's actually mentioned in the American Supreme Court as well, in one of their, going way back, but still. And then now, Priestley. Why Priestley?
Well, people know him as the discoverer of oxygen and for his writings on electricity, but his contemporaries knew him really as a social liberal as well. He was a dissenter. He didn't take the established religion. And he wrote an important book on the first principles of government, it was called. Again, we're talking the mid-1700s. And he argued for free speech and religious toleration and political rights and against slavery and all other things that were sort of taken for granted. And he favoured toleration in particular, and toleration for dissenters who were officially barred from public positions. He, I think, distinguished political rights, which are granted to citizens in a political community, from civil rights, which he said were due to everybody by virtue of the fact that they're human beings. And he said that those civil rights should be as wide as possible. So he, before Hayek, sort of identified a public and private sphere and said the private sphere should be as large as possible. And he called for toleration in religious and other parts of life.
And then last but not least, Josephine Butler.
Yes, well, no relation of mine, but she made liberal feminism a very powerful force and put a lot of very difficult issues.
How are you defining liberal feminism? Because that word has been... it has a somewhat different definition, doesn't it, now?
Well, I suppose that's true. I think she certainly believed that women should have equal rights. Mm-hmm. For example, there was... I should explain. She was married to a church teacher, and his work took them to Liverpool. She got involved in family welfare issues. She rescued girls from the workhouse and tried to give them useful work. She... campaigned against child prostitution because she found child prostitutes as young as 12, and campaigned for the age of consent to be raised from 13 to 16, which ultimately was successful. But to give an example of what she sort of understood by feminism, it would be the equality of rights. For example, in her time, the mid-1800s, the police had the power to arrest women in ports and military towns, and they could force them to a medical examination to make sure they didn't have any sexually transmitted infections. And if they resisted, they'd be put in jail. And Butler argued that this, firstly, it encouraged harassment of women by the police, but it removed women's rights while doing nothing to restrain men, who are, I put it to you, equally responsible for the spread of sexual diseases. Yes. You see? So it was very unusual for women at the time to speak on these things, which were thought to be very delicate issues and unladylike to speak of them. But she did it, and she employed new campaigning systems, and particularly the railways, going and speaking at events and meetings. And this was thought to be slightly shocking by some people. But ultimately, she succeeded in that law. That law was swept away. And she fought to expand female education, was a co-founder of Newnham College, the women-only college in Cambridge. Great girl.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder then, to conclude, if you'd, I guess, summarise what you want young, because it will primarily be younger people that are picking this up and reading this primer, and you do such a fantastic job with all of your primers, but I wonder what would you like people to take away from this? How would you like people to be challenged by what's contained in it?
I think simply to realise that there is a great and international history of liberal ideas, and that the liberal debate, you asked me whether liberalism is dead. No, it's not dead. There's a liberal debate which has gone on for at least 3,000 years and which continues to this day, and which is very lively and exciting. And I would hope that my readers at the end of this book would think to themselves, this is really exciting stuff. There is such a lot in this. There's all these different ideas, you know, spontaneous order and rights and the role of the state and women's rights and, you know, all sorts of things going on, property and so on. Lots and lots of debates are still in currency. And I just like them to think, gosh, this is really exciting. I could contribute to this debate.
And it is exciting as well. Well, Eamon, thank you very much for joining the IEA today. And if people want to find you on social media, what's your Twitter handle?
Oh, I haven't the foggiest idea.
Search Eamon Butler in Twitter. He's very good anyway. Yes, he is. Right, thank you, Eamon. Now, listeners can download 101 Great Liberal Thinkers at... hold it up, yes, perfect, at iea.org.uk, and you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is you get your podcast, and let me know what you think of the book at IEA London. Cheers for listening. I've been Darren Grimes, and this has been Live from Lord North Street.